All right, we're going to go ahead and get started to make sure we have enough time to get through everything today. Thank you for coming to the Stats and Methodology Corps lecture series. I'm Julie Lons Taylor, the Educational Director for the Corps at the Kennedy Center. And before we get started with Dr. Brown's lecture, I'd like to just make a few quick announcements to let you know that our next lecture is going to be on March 24th. And it's what we call a partners lecture, which means a Kennedy Center investigator presents a substantive topic, and then a statistician will get up and talk about some of the statistical issues that they've encountered and how they've solved those. So it's an interesting way to try to bridge the substantive research with the statistical methodology. And then May 12th through 14th, Helena Kramer is going to be at Vanderbilt giving a series of lectures across campus. And any Kennedy Center investigators who are interested in getting some time with her, probably in a group format, I'll be sending out an email probably in the next couple weeks gauging interest in people who want to have meetings with her. So again, that is May 12th through the 14th. And then finally, if you're not on our list to get emails about our statistical and methodology workshops and lectures, there's a sign-up sheet in the back. Make sure you sign up on that, and I'll make sure you get on the list and get the emails. So we are delighted to have Dr. Tony Brown talking today about missing data. He is an associate professor in sociology here at Vanderbilt, and he has affiliations with a number of other places on campus, the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, the Department of Psychology and Human Development, the Vanderbilt Center for Nashville Studies, and the Program in African American and Diaspora Studies. His research interests include mental health, race, and racism, and quantitative methodology. So let's welcome Dr. Tony Brown.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and pass out a couple handouts. I'm not sure how much I'm going to be able to get through. I have quite a bit to cover today. Thank you for having me. I want to talk about methods for handling and recovering missing data in social surveys. This is an applied talk. I like to think about it that way, more than a heavy math talk. So what I want to cover today, causes of missing data, the nature of missing data, why we want to recover missing data, approaches to missing data. I'm going to give you an example of something that happened to me and how I worked it out. And then I'm going to just draw up some basic conclusions about missing data. So what causes missing data? The first thing is there's non-response at the unit of analysis. So you might think about a rectangular data set, and there's missing rows. And that could be any number of reasons that can happen. Typically in the social sciences, we think about acceptable response rates being approximately 70% or so. So that means we're willing to accept 30% non-response. Study designs sometimes skip patterns cause missing data. There are certainly questions we don't want to ask every respondent, but sometimes we make mistakes about who we ask questions of. Computer or coder error, this was something I discovered in some of my own work. Triple coding is a rule. Questionnaire length, I think, is almost perfectly correlated with break-offs. The longer the questionnaire, it tends to be you'll have some monotone missing data, and I'll describe that shortly. Unclear question wording. There are times when we have double-barreled questions, when we have questions that are poorly constructed, and I think those lead to ambiguities and don't-knows and sometimes refusals. Respondents' privacy concerns and disbelief in confidentiality. Attrition and longitudinal designs. Some of the best data around, at least in sociology, has a lot of missing data over time because it's difficult to follow people up, and then other unknowns. So what's the nature of missing data? Well, most of us pretend we don't have problems with missing data. You have to search really carefully in that method section for that two sentences that says, we took care of the missing data. And that's probably not adequate. In part, that happens because most of us don't know how to handle our missing data problems. And so we write the two sentences, reviewers read the two sentences, and we pretend like everything is okay. As such, I'm going to make this bold statement. If you remember nothing from this talk but this bold statement, remember this. As such, missing data is the single greatest flaw in social science research. Okay, you let me get away with it? Okay, we'll roll with that. We'll try it. Oh, okay, according to Tony Brown, Kim. There are generally two patterns of missing data. And I'm thinking now about the variable level, not necessarily the row or case level, and that's monotone and arbitrary. Almost all social science data sets conform to the arbitrary pattern. So the arbitrary pattern looks something like this. For each case, there are people who complete the entire set of the questionnaire or survey, and there are people who break off. There are people break off at various points. And so the data don't always look like this, but the data can be rearranged like this. And if it could be rearranged like this, we tend to think about the missing data as monotone. And then there's something that probably looks more familiar to all of us, the shotgun approach. Arbitrary. Who knows what happened, why certain questions are there. There are people who start and then have one blip and then finish. People who have two blips, you're never quite sure. But this is what most of the data that we're going to look at, most of the data we're going to analyze looks like. So we hypothesize that missing data in our surveys are generally one of three things. They're either MCAR, missing completely at random, and some people use the term accessible, mainly statisticians. Missing at random, MAR, accessible, and then missing not at random, or MNAR, or non-ignorable or inaccessible. So let me talk about these three ways we hypothesize to describe our missing data. Questions? Oh. Okay. MCAR, missing values represent a random sample of variable values, so we don't think there's anything systematic about who answered or didn't answer. Essentially, it's a random sample. MAR, missing values are a function of the variable itself. The classic thing in social science research is income. No one wants to tell you how much money they made. It's a function of other observed variables. So once we control for education, we understand something about the distribution of income. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we have some sense of that, meaning we expect that almost, as opposed to MNAR, where missing values are linked to unobserved variables, and or they must be modeled simultaneous to the estimation of the substantive model. Some of you are probably familiar with the Heckman correction for selection, where we're going to create a inverse Mills ratio to represent the probability of something. And that's essentially the probability of having data. And then we include that in a predictive model. So we have to do something beyond controlling. We actually have to somehow model the missingness that we're looking at. Is everybody together? Are we all together? Good. So this is the question I get asked all the time. How much missing data is problematic? And people always want me to give them a particular answer. And so my answer is, it depends. So it depends on whether units of analysis are missing. So I recently actually had an article rejected because the response rate was 32%. And so for some people, missing 68% of our units was really problematic. And yet we see these declines in response rates over time. The second thing, or B, whether the response or predictors or both are missing. So some of the ways I'm going to talk about recovering missing data only work for the independent variable or the dependent variable, and some work for both. But the idea is you've got to make a decision about which technique you're going to use based on whether you have dependent variable or response variables that are missing, or values that are missing, and predictors or independent variables. What proportion of data for a typical unit analysis are missing? And your analytic philosophy. And so my analytic philosophy now has revolved to recover everything at all costs. Because it simply is a lot of effort that we expend to collect data. So why recover? Because I spent summers upon summers in the field interviewing people, and I want all of that data. At ISR, when I was there, we talked about how much it takes to move from having a sample frame to actually having the data collected and coded, and it was like $1,200, $1,500 for a person in the national survey. So that's money and time we want to recover. here's the big one. Statistical programs default is complete case analysis. So if you just throw your stuff into a computer, your data, and analyze it, it's going to assume you have complete cases. All rows are filled. There are no missing data. Improved statistical power, obviously, our standard errors are based upon our sample sizes. And then unbiased estimation and efficiency. We have estimators that operate or perform better when the variance of certain quantities is smaller. So now let me get to approaches to missing data. And I categorize these maybe a little differently than some people do, but let's just say there are three. Listwise and pairwise deletion, dummy variable adjustment, and imputation. And I wanted to note that these methods deal with recovery of missing data on variables, not the recovery of cases. They're not going to recover rows of missing data. They're going to recover those values that are throughout your data frame. So I started to simulate data and show you how this works, but a lot of people have done that. That's in the literature. So I wanted to bring to you my problem. And this happened to me several years ago. I'm now over it. I've recovered. I was asked to look at predicting self-reported health, which is a very good predictor of mortality, how well you rate your own health. And I was given a range of predictors to do this. And so I came up with a set of predictors based on what I was told to do. And I used this 1995 Detroit area study, which is a data set I was intimately connected to because I helped design it and collect the data. And so I had kind of two research questions. I was showing up at a meeting to present to some people. And one was exercise related to better health? I think we know, yes. And do men have better health than women? And this was the more interesting question. And so the actual sample size, the number in we report in data, is 1,139. So 1,139. I want you to keep that in mind. And so I'm just going to do an OLS regression. And I'm going to have a series of predictors. In fact, there are 9 predictors. So K is going to go to 9. I'm not sure what that is. That should probably not be there. And then I'm going to have a response variable that I'm going to call health rate. And it's self-reported health status. It goes from 1 to 5. 5 was excellent. 1 is poor. So it's ordinal. I know I shouldn't do OLS. But again, I want to represent what I actually did and tell you what happened. Predictors, I have age and years, exercise number of times the last 2 weeks, chance that you have contracted HIV or AIDS, sleep, the number, average number a week, I think, education, family income, weight, hip-waist ratio, and a dummy variable for whether you're a woman or a man, okay? So this is the first thing I do. I always tell students in my stats class, always take a look at the data, see what you're working with before you go anywhere. Make sure everything looks right. And so I'm looking at health rate. There's no missing data on the dependent variable. I'm looking at age, only a couple cases. Exercise, a couple cases, 10 or so. Chance age, about 13. Sleep, about 20. 5 for education, so far so good. Uh-oh, family income. 611. Weight, 1105. That's better than I might have predicted. Hip waist ratio, whether you're apple, pear shaped, essentially, 722. And women, I have no missing data on gender. So I look at this and I say, okay, I'm probably pretty good to go. I need to be careful about family income and hip waist. I may have to think about what that means at some point in the future. So I proceed to go through running an analysis. And obviously, the default in almost all the major programs that we use is complete case analysis, which is based on listwise deletion. So technically, listwise deletion is only appropriate if values are MCAR or MAR. So missing completely at random or missing at random. So you're going to deal with the variables that cause them to be missing. So I took this data and, oh, wait. I'll skip the step. So the problems with this is the estimation sample changes with addition or removal of variables. You'll see your N fluctuate, and then there's a loss of statistical power and accuracy. So both of those things will be demonstrated here. So when I looked at the number missing, it turns out that my listwise N would have been 367. Now remember, we started with 1,139. Remember I said, oh, well, we have a couple issues with just hip waist and income, which had 600-700 cases. But it turns out those cases don't overlap. So I end up getting down to 367 cases. Now, I didn't do this step initially. And so what I did was this. And so I arrived at the meeting, and I didn't look at the 367. And I get asked the question, well, does it matter? Does exercise matter? Well, it seems to matter. The coefficient is about 0.025. The standard error, keep an eye on the standard errors and the probabilities of the T's, is about 0.008. In terms of women, this would be, we'd expect it to be negative if I was hypothesizing men had better health. It was indeed negative, but it wasn't statistically significant. And so somewhere in the meeting, someone said, what happened to the other cases? And I said, oh, yeah, so let me figure out what happened to the other cases. So there's another option, less popular except in SPSS, and that's to compute summary statistics and estimates using all available information for each pair of variables. It's difficult to imagine doing this, and in fact, I had trouble doing it in Stata. And in R, you can do anything, but I wasn't going to actually write in that formula. I'll work on it over the summer. But statistically appropriate only if the values are MCAR. So what's the problems with this approach? The estimation sample is unknown or debatable, because if you're relying on pairs of variables to contribute, what is your N? It's only practical for statistical analyses where correlation matrix can be input data. And that's a lot of different programs, but some not necessarily. And it's then difficult to diagnose the bias, because each pair of variables is contributing, but you're not quite sure how much each one is contributing. So if I rerun this again, and this is in SPSS, I now use a pairwise option. Let's skip straight here. So now it says I have 389 cases. I don't know how I have 389 cases. It says essentially that exercise is important, but notice how much bigger the standard area is here. And it also says that women, actually men do report better health, significantly better health. So now I have contradictory results. I'm not quite sure what to make of this, and I still don't know how I have 389 cases. So there's a next movement up in the progression in terms of thinking about techniques or methods. This technique is one that became really popular. I saw it a lot in 90s in sociology journals. Dummy variable adjustment. So you plug in a value, typically the sample mean for missing values on a variable. And that's actually synonymous with something we'll call marginal mean substitution. And you create a dummy variable coded 1 if the original variable is missing, 0 otherwise. So you have the original variable, you filled in the missing data with the mean, and then you have a dummy variable indicating whether that variable you filled in was missing or not missing. You include the dummy variable in the regression models. It's easily programmable in all of the standard packages. Now, what are some, before I get to the problem, it avoids loss of power. It capitalizes on available information. If you have a non-significant dummy variable, that dummy variable you create is not significant, supposedly that indicates randomness, that your missingness does not influence or bias your results. Now, there's been some simulation studies. Paul Allison has done some interesting things looking at bias estimates, and apparently we know they're biased, but we don't know whether it's up or down. We don't know whether the standard errors are up or down and whether the coefficients are up or down. So I basically did this really quickly for family income and for waist hip. Those were the two variables that had the greatest amount of missing data. And so I generated a new variable called imputed family income, and I gave it a value of the mean of family income if it was missing on the original variable. And then I generated a dummy variable and then basically created a one category if these two didn't match. And those two would not match if one was missing and one was not missing. And I used the same procedure for waist hip. And so this essentially shows you the dummy variables I created. Basically, this corresponds to what we know to be the cases I have, right? 611, 722. And I'm going to include this dummy variable with the original variable into this model. So now I have a larger sample size, 1,055. So now let's take a look at our standard errors again. Now we get a standard error of about 0.006. And we find out that exercise is indeed important. The more you exercise, the better rate your health. And women do report worse health than men. Men report better health than women, and this appears significant to standard error about 0.07. Now, interestingly, notice I didn't impute anything that had to deal with exercise or with women, the two variables that are substantively interesting to me. I imputed variables that were other control variables. And so that's another part to think about. Sometimes the variables you're interested in may not have any missing cases, but the control variables do, and obviously there's a correlation among lots of things. And so you have to be really sensitive to what these coefficients mean if they're important to you, but also how they might change another coefficient. So let me talk about types of imputation. Marginal mean substitution, which I mentioned already, conditional mean substitution or single imputation, hot decking, cold decking, and I may just gloss over hot decking or cold decking in the interest of time, and multiple imputation. So marginal mean substitution we talked a bit about before. We're going to plug in the sample mean for missing values on variables. Now, obviously, that could be independent or dependent variables. This avoids a loss of statistical power. The problem is, and you know this, if you guess the average, you're underestimating variability because typically, yes, we're average, but there is variation around the mean. And this may be especially the case, for example, in the idea of income. When we find out, as Barr said, people who have low or high income don't report, then suggesting that they're the mean may misrepresent income's effect. And we see this in biased standard errors and inflated R-squares. So I basically stuck in the means, and notice those are the same. I get the same N as when dummy variable adjustment, because I'm essentially doing the first half of the dummy variable adjustment, just plugging in the means. And again, we see some differences in the coefficients, but largely about the same. And when we take a look at, there was one other thing I wanted to show you. The R squared, and I didn't flag it on another one. This one's significantly higher than the last R squared. In part, that happens because you're predicting the mean, the regression line passes through the mean, so it looks like your model obviously fits a lot better because there's less, you're definitely going to have a very small residual from predicting the mean. Conditional mean substitution. Now, here we're going to estimate a prediction equation and use those coefficients to generate plausible values. So we have some available data. Let's create a prediction equation and then plug in what we have, get that equation, and then basically substitute in values and fill in our data. Now that avoids loss of power by boosting the estimation sample size. It's easily implemented in the standard programs. The problems, it's not fully efficient, in part because what we're doing is probabilistic, it's not deterministic. Not everyone who has the same education has the same income. So there has to be this probabilistic approach to it because there's error terms around particular things. So there's a neat function in Stata that will do this for you, basically. And as you see this, I'm using all variables to impute all other variables. If it had any missing whatsoever, I'm going to impute it. And I think Pat Royston wrote this function or do. And you basically generate a new variable. And this will fill in your data set. It'll basically create new variables, this imputed IMP, 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 IMP. Those are the new variables that essentially represent the conditional mean substitution. Yes? Yes.
So what kind of approach do you use to get those?
Right. That's it. Perfectly clear. Listwise deletion. So I'm going to throw away any values that aren't valid on waist hip when I'm using it as a predictor, and then when it's a dependent variable as well. Good question. Thanks. And so I did that, and I want to just highlight a couple things. First, I have all the data now. All the data, whatever that means. I have 1,139 cases. But here was the original family income, and this is when I just substituted the marginal mean in. And notice it goes from $167 a month to over $260. Now here's the one I use conditional mean substitution. I use a regression prediction equation to substitute values. Now someone makes minus $28,600. Well, that's possible in today's economy. That's probably not a real valid data number. And that'll bring us to some issues we'll get to when we talk about multiple imputation, creating bounds for predictive values and figuring out how things work, because sometimes our regression equations give us a number, but does the number make sense relative to the data we're using? But anyway, hooray, I found all the data. So now when I do this conditional mean substitution, I now have these new variables I have imputed. Here's the big number. All of them are there. Here's an interesting, so I had a standard error that I think we started at 0.008. Now it's 0.005. So that's a sizable drop in our standard error. And then I have a coefficient for a standard error for women that is larger, I think. However, the coefficient is also larger. So we end up having a significant effect. So according to this model with conditional mean substitution, I'm going to conclude that exercise is important, and that men do report better health. So we see some problems with almost everything we've done in terms of methods so far. And so that led me a couple years ago to begin to play around with and think about multiple imputation. And it basically starts with conditional mean substitution, but then adds in and fills in ways that better represent the variable process that creates our frequentist data sets. So multiple imputation involves repeating the same analysis on several complete imputed data sets and then combining the point estimates and the variances. So we're going to not only make a single complete data set, we're going to make several. Now randomness is added to each sample regression estimate to represent the process that underlies what we do in terms of probability, because the process involves error. We have a regression coefficient that comes from a sample of regression coefficients. So we have to represent that. We have people who have the same amount of income, who have same amount of education, who have different income. So we have to have an error to represent that as well. So we're trying to add that randomness back into the process. Now in this case, we'll have variables. In this case, we have K through 9. We have 9 variables, and they may have missing data. We're going to regress each of those variables on all the other variables in the same way we did with conditional mean substitution. We're going to replace the missing values in X1 based on that regression. And then we're going to repeat for X2, XK, and on for all the X's. And this is complete a single cycle. Now we're going to repeat that cycle 10 times. And some people call these iterations. And in this cycle, we essentially are going to do it 10 times, and then we're going to stop, and we're going to take that final data set that was produced from this cycle of constantly filling in the data based on, as random as it could be, some random estimation of the variability in our coefficients. So we end up with a complete data set. Then we start all over again and do that 5 times. So we'll end up with about 5 data sets. And in this case, we're calling that M. That's the number of complete data sets. Now, these data sets only differ in that the missing data is different. We use a random process in each of those missing data sets to complete it, and now we have 5 different data sets that are complete, and the only thing that's different across them is that the values that are filled in for are missing. And then we'll ultimately combine our estimates after we run analysis on the 5 complete, and we'll construct some confidence intervals, and we'll be able to tell you whether the variability created from replacing the missing has impacted or biased our coefficients and our estimation. So what we're doing is creating an efficient sample of plausible values. So I like to think about it like this. There's a single missing value. that missing value probably comes from a distribution of missing values or a distribution of real values. And we're going to find five of those real values, and we're going to substitute that into the five complete data sets. Now, the multiply imputed estimate, we're going to call it Q in this case, is a regression coefficient, and it's basically estimated as the average of the different regression coefficients across the complete data sets. We're going to construct a within imputation variance, and that's basically going to be the standard errors associated with each regression coefficient, and that's going to be the sum of those. That's what's blocked out there. And then we're going to have a between imputation variance, which is obviously going to look at how each of the coefficients varies from some average coefficient. So we got between, within variance, and we've got an overall coefficient average.
The random piece in each of those iterations. Where does that come from? Is that, are you going to talk about that? How random is it? Is it bounded? How do you think those are going to narrow your statements for that?
Yeah, I'll talk about that. The answer is wow. That's basically the short answer, because there's so many ways to think about how you add the randomness. There's different strategies for using the randomness. There's stuff related directly to full maximum likelihoods, stuff related to additive regression stuff. But most of it, and the question is, some people call it a Bayesian analysis, and yet some people argue it's not. So we don't know enough to know what the best way to do this is yet, but we do know it's better than what we've been doing. Yeah, and I'll talk about that in a second. That is the major problem as I see it right now, one of my big take-home points. There's no paper that looks at, within a package, how the different procedures perform. And there's very few, I don't think there's any, there may be one or two, actually, that compare imputation procedures across packages. And so it's really hard to set the same parameters to see if you get the same results, because those two things are moving at the same time. And I'll give you some citations for some of that as well. So we'll get a total estimate that's a combination of the between and within, within and between variances. And then essentially, that test of Q bar, the test of the average coefficient, is reduced to a simple t-test. So what are the problems? And I'm glad you mentioned the second one. Software, difficult to program across the board. I have option available in SPSS. We'll talk about that. And mostly it's user contributed in SAS, Stata, and R. It's not something that's built into the main package. It's something that's been added on. So there are bugs and there are inconsistencies that that I think pop up into some of what we're seeing. Here's the bigger issue for me. There's multiple mathematical estimation approaches. And there's no real gold standard. There's chained equations. There's stuff that involves additive regressions. I mean, so it's not quite, there's nothing we could say, well, this is the thing we use and everybody uses it. So there's obviously a need for more validation studies to get to a point where we can figure out what works best and when it works best. So let me just use one of the easier things to program. And this is a function called ICE. Imputation via chained equations. And this is available in Stata. And this is actually the old version of ICE. In Stata 10, and I think actually in Stata 9, there's a new version of ICE that's a lot fancier. And it makes it clearer in terms of what it's doing. But essentially, you put in all the variables. You tell it what the data set is. You can tell it what kind of variable you have. So these are ordinal variables. I certainly want to use the appropriate regression for the technique that I'm, the variable that's the dependent variable based on this probability distribution. And then I'm going to say 10 cycles, and the rest of this is how I want to label some things in 5, and then you give it the number of multiples or output it complete data sets, and then a seed so it can start, so I can obviously replicate this if I need to. So this is the simplest approach that's probably out there, but remember, in your data set, you probably have 100 variables. You don't just have 10, so this looks much longer. And it's much more complicated because you have probably things that are dichotomous, things that are ordinal, things that are take a Poisson distribution. So you have a lot of different variables in your data set. So this is a lot easier to do because I only have two that are ordinal. But it becomes much more complicated as you deal with real data. So here's what I begin, here's where I'll begin in terms of what's output. I have five data sets, and they're basically stacked. And what separates them is I have a variable called underscore j, and that tells me the imputation. So for the first j, I have 1,139 cases. Second j, 1,139 cases. 1,139 cases, 1,139 cases. So I end up with 5,695 cases. Now, that's not the number of cases I have. I have five complete data sets stacked on top of each other. So to give you a sense of what happens here, now ICE uses something called predictive mean matching, so you don't end up with values outside, where's income? So you don't end up with values outside the range, so it has some bounds built into it. And it has some other really nice features. Now, it's not the high-end one in terms of change equations, but you end up with what looks like a really clean set of data to work with. So your next step then, and much of this is automated through functions that are like MI combined, that will then take these five data sets and analyze them together and then produce a set of estimates. So I'm going to run, this is basically running this original model on the first multiple. And so that's 1,139 cases. And you can look at a couple things. Maybe look at exercise here. But remember, we had a lot of missing data on income and hip weight. So you might also watch it as those numbers change. So I run it on this complete case once. And MI combined will then run it on the second imputation. And so we have different numbers across here. Some of these numbers are changing. The third imputation, the fourth, and the fifth. And what's interesting is, let's just look at hip weights. They had a lot of missing data. So significant in the fifth, marginal in the fourth, not at all in the third, significant in the second, and not at all in the first. The only reason those numbers are changing is we've now imputed missing data and put them into each of the five data sets, so that we can do the complete case analysis. So the missing data are causing those coefficients to move. And what you end up with that's kind of nice out of MI combined is this table that sets it all up for you and gives you the Q bar, the average coefficient, and it actually computes the variance that goes with that average coefficient and then does the t-test. And so we conclude that waist hip actually isn't important. We conclude that exercise is important. Women do report worse health than men, and income was significant. But the only reason we have these differences and the only reason we end up with this confidence interval is that we have a point estimate, and that varies across imputations. So I want to have some time to talk about all of this. So two basic conclusions. Don't tolerate missing data. It's you don't have to. You have viable options. And one of my favorite lines is Paul Allison's, the only real good solution to missing data is not to have any. And every time I go over to biostats, there's this line just like that about, you know, don't call us to fix something that you've already destroyed. And essentially, that's the big take-home point. Do it well up front, and you'll have less problems in the back end. And just really quickly, there are other topics I want to talk about, but I wanted to get to software. Maybe I'll just show you some of the software. So Stata has a couple functions you could check out. Impute, hot deck, and mice. Use the function findIt for missing. R has tons of different things. You could just basically choose your poison, if you will. SAS has Proc MI and MI Analyze. I think this is really neat. Here's what I learned to use. It's IVEware. It was developed at ISR. In some ways it's a macro, so you have to have SAS for it to work, although they're working on making it a standalone. And then this is one of my favorite lines here. There's supposedly an imputation process in SPSS 17. How many people have SPSS 17? Wow. Okay. Have you seen it in SPSS 17? No. Yeah, they've been saying this since 14. So I'm not quite sure what's going on, but I don't think it's actually going to be coming out. And I'll stop right there and open up for questions, but do give you a couple things to read. I think if you want to start, the Allison is a great place to start in terms of giving a sense of all of these issues. So, questions?